Orm selected the best organisms for the task. Infiltration creatures with high combat capability were automatically deployed. Dozens of gene stealers came in ones and twos, moving stealthily so that the gathering group would not be noticed. Another safeguard. They would not be seen anyway. The eyes of the Space Marines were upon the sea of monsters attacking the second wall. 20 minutes went by, a meaningless measurement of a meaningless span to the eternal hive mind. Sand suddenly hissed away into a rapidly widening hole, and the lictor plunged in. The gene stealers followed. They ran along a pitch-black tunnel, needing no light to see. They passed under the moat, the fallen third line, and the curtain wall without detection, their movements masked by gunfire. At the far end, the two Trigons attacked the plug seal with acidic spittle and teeth with monomolecular edges. The ground rumbled around them to the steady heartbeat tremors of artillery fire. No sand fell from the resin-bonded roof. Acid ate through metal easily. When that had dribbled away to noxious fluid, the prey creature's false rock dissolved just as fast, revealing a thick, rustless plasteel pipe piercing the foot of the Ark's murus. The wall was of diamond-hard volcanic glass rock. Eating through that would have taken days. Time equaled detection. The simple plug in the pipe's jacket took only hours. A hole opened. The Trigons rapidly gnawed at the edges to widen it. Toxic vapors steamed from the material as it dissolved, shortening the creature's lives by years. Another consideration meaningless to the hive mind. Silently, the Trigons pushed aside the rotting material. It scattered into damp, steaming sands. The pipe within the fortress remained. The lictor paused, multiple senses reaching out into the depths of the fortress monastery. The air was stale. The machines were dead. Nothing had moved down there for generations. As one, the infiltration splinter poured into the Arx Angelicum. They ran soundlessly down the pipe, reaching a junction. A further seal barred the way. Bioacid reduced it to metal-rich liquid in moments. Acid vapors dispersed on feeble currents. The lictor tasted the air. Its olfactory sense was sensitive to chemical components at 1 or 2 parts per million. The amount of data it processed would have confounded an advanced cogitation unit. Thousands of compounds, borne on multiple air vortices from locations it had never seen, were processed in fractions of a second. It found what it was looking for. There were two targets. It tasted them both quickly. A diversion and the objective. The diversion would drive the prey into a rage and conceal the second. Prey always fought hardest to protect its young. Dante fought on the wall. The kill zone was a field of burning wrecks. Dozens of priceless war machines lay broken in the desert. Dante had a chilling flash of prescience, seeing their unrusting hulks beneath an airless sky, the Arx Angelicum in ruins behind them. Not yet. The chapters of the blood still lived. The consumption phase was hearteningly late in beginning. The wall still held. The void shield stood. Between the vehicle wrecks, the sand was carpeted in shattered white and purple chitin. Desert that had not felt the kiss of moisture for a billion years was soaked in alien fluids. Assault after assault was thrown back from the restored curtain wall. Guns roared and boomed all day and night. The sky was a constant pyrotechnical display of flak and lazlight. If they stood alone, Dante would have been more careful with his ammunition, but the Blood Angel's successors had brought millions of tons of ammunition with them, and so he allowed the cannons of his fortress to fire and fire. In the dark, their muzzles glowed with heat. The desert shook with explosive impacts, and the constant, quiet tremble of the Arx Angelicum's reactors working at maximum capacity to supply energy to las emplacements, plasma turrets, and shielding. Any other army would have withdrawn from the siege. The Arx Angelicum would have been impregnable to any other foe, its 10,000 defenders too great to overcome. The Tyranids cared nothing for death. They threw their living bombs at the fortress monastery, not caring or understanding that they would never hit their target. The void shields groaned and snapped. The flicker of displacement was a noisy aurora around the Space Marine's position. Floating spore mines were slow enough to pass through, but as they were drawn to the noise of war, They were targeted and blasted apart by Icarus LAS cannons and quad autocannon anti-air defenses. A near-constant rain of acid fell from these clouds of living bombs, too diffuse to do anything but scorch the colors from the battle plate of the Space Marines. The aerial swarm, too, might fly through at the correct speed, but their beasts had withdrawn in the face of heavy casualties, leaving the sky to the racket of exploding flak rounds and the crash of phosphorescent chemicals splashing to nothing against the Aegis. Along the curtain wall, emplaced heavy bolters chugged, panning back and forth monotonously, sweeping away gene-stealers, gaunts, and warriors. The wet crack of splintering chitin and alien death screams were a hellish symphony that played without pause. There were enough Space Marines to man the parapets shoulder to shoulder. Bolt guns fired from every embrasure, destroying the lesser bioforms by the thousand. It was a tactic of the hive mind to pile up its dead to render any defensive line unusable, as it had at the moat. But the Tyranids could not get close enough to the wall. An embankment of heaped corpses provided a little shelter to the advancing swarm. There yet remained a clear killing field between it and Dante's wall. It crept forwards a few feet every day as corpses rolled from the top. In strict rotation, sections of the wall were cleared by concentrated melter fire, plasma incineration, and promethium bombs to stop the heap of dead becoming a ramp. In doing so, the Space Marines created a thick black smoke screen in front of the sections under clearance, obscuring the view and encouraging attack. So these minor advantages were traded back and forth between the two sides. None gained a decisive edge. The fortress was inviolable, the Tyranids practically infinite. A Bio-Titan shrieked as it was blasted to pieces by a defense laser. There were fewer of the large constructs coming. Dante's army was killing them faster than they could be bred. Slowly, the swarm was being worn down. Stalemate was not a victory, but it was better than the alternative. Every day the Arx Angelicum held, the chances of triumph increased. Garbled reports burst through the Tyranids' vox jamming every so often, reporting successful hit-and-run raids on the Hive Fleet. These could sometimes be seen in daytime through the watery shimmer of the void shield and the flowering of flak. At night, these battles lit up the heavens. Defense lasers aided in thinning the orbital swarm. Most of these powerful weapons could only be fired a few times a day, but when they did, they invariably claimed a kill apiece. Each meteor shower of burning alien meat streaking across Baal's sky brought another cheer from the wall's defenders. Back and forth. For every 10 Tyranid ships destroyed, another strike cruiser was lost. Reactor deaths made brilliant suns. Messages from Baal Primus and Baal Secundus were just as likely to tell of defeat or chapters decimated as they were to report positions held. Everything depended on the void shield. Hold that, and the swarm would be blunted, broken, and finally turned aside. Until then, the hive mind would throw its endless armies at the curtain wall, employing variant strategies each time. The enemy's latest gambit approached. Hundreds of hulking carnifexes bulled their way through the hordes, trampling their smaller kin. They were giant assault beasts, their short limbs thick with muscle, domed backs, protected by inches of chitinous armor, powerful weapon symbiotes bonded to their flesh. There were bigger Tyranid constructs, but none were as numerous nor so versatile as the Carnifexes. Heavy weapons fire burned the air over the curtain wall from the fortress, striking at the hulking monsters and laying them low by the dozen. There were too many to stop. Several broods were protected by floating psychic abominations, which projected fields of warp energy, proof against all but the heaviest guns. Others marched under the cover of toxic fogs, whose swirling spores foiled target locks as easily as they choked human lungs. Dante watched from a low drum tower that shook with the recoil of its turreted macro cannon. Five of his sanguinary guard, led by Brother Dontoriel, hero of Cryptus, were arrayed around him in a protective circle. The Carnifexes were getting close to the berm of the dead, disrupting attempts to hit them. Fountains of limbs and Xenos flesh pattered down where shells tore into the bank. "In a few more moments they will come under the shadow of the walls," said Dante. "Then we will see how well the foe will test us." The encircling Carnifexes ploughed through the embankment of the dead, causing it to tumble forward closer to the walls. Some of them were doing so deliberately, shoving corpses ahead of them, banking them up at the foot of the wall. Closer examination showed they had adaptations specifically for this role, with massive flattened claws that locked together like dozer blades. Dante checked visual feed from auger eyes and the helmets of his fellow chapter masters. The same was occurring in several places. "Prioritize Carnifex forms pushing forward the dead," he ordered, switching to Battleforce wide vox. The Arx Angelicum amplified his signal through its powerful communication center, but even so, the return feed was full of the chilling voice of the hive mind. The last of the weapons fired from the Fortress Monastery cut out. The Carnifexes were too close to the curtain wall. The Arx's guns redirected their punishing bombardment to a second wave coming behind the first, leaving the leading Carnifexes to the heavy weapons mounted on the second line, so the attack was under fire from the curtain wall alone. Dante scanned quickly through the thumbnail views from around the wall. He halted at one. Six Carnifexes were absorbing an obscene amount of fire, heaping the dead at the foot of the wall as stolidly as serfs digging in the rain. "Chapter Master Oryx, you have a breakthrough imminent in your sector. Please deal with it," he said. In another place, the enemy had sent a spearhead of giant serpentine forms to race at the wall and scrabble up it with vestigial claws. One nearly made it before a plasma cannon shot took off its head and set it alight. "Captain Theus, attend to those Trigons," Dante commanded, his voice as always clear and steely. Minor breakthroughs could be contained. It was crucial there were no major breaches of the wall. Still the rain of spores fell. Still the hissing sea of lesser forms leapt and snapped, those few who made the wall's base scrambling partway up the smooth rockcrete before slipping back. Others waited with mindless patience for the ramps to be finished, relatively unmolested by gunfire, while the defenders concentrated on the siege beasts. Should the Carnifexes build their macabre ramps, there would be thousands of Tyranids within the second perimeter in moments. Dante's hand tightened on the Arx Mortalis. There was not much he could do but trust in the skill and devotion of the Chapters of the Blood. A desperate vox call cut into the inter-chapter traffic. "The wall! The wall! Carnifex brood coming over the wall!" Dante's attention snapped to a place half a mile from his bastion. Four monsters there eschewed the heaping of corpses and were attempting an escalade. They made their own ladders as they climbed, smashing out holes in the rockcrete with their giant claws. Flesh hooks whipped out from chest cavities and scrabbled for extra traction, hauling them farther up the wall towards the warriors at the top. Dante was close and first to respond. He leapt from the bastion and jetted high, his guard following instantly. His jump-pack fuel indicator fell quickly. Baal's gravity was strong. Sustained flight could therefore only be brief, and so he leaned forward, willing himself to reach the crisis point before it was too late. He roared over hundreds of space marines firing from the wall. Blades of light stabbed out, a weft of las beams that died and replenished itself over and over again. A Carnifex imploded below, peppered with so many crack bombs it collapsed into itself in a shower of gore. The small explosions of bolt shells were so numerous that it seemed the war was conducted to the layered playing of a million insane drummers. Washes of flame, so intense Dante felt the heat through his armor, drove back hordes of gaunts from a nearly completed corpse ramp. Dozens shriveled in the heat. Thick promethium gels adhered to the larger monsters, coating them head to foot with flame, but the Carnifexes continued working, immune to pain, even as their eyes cooked in their sockets. A flight of gargoyles screamed at Dante and his guard, only to be blasted apart by quad cannon fire before they got within 100 yards. His fuel indicators dipped towards amber, hurrying for the red of exhaustion, and then he was there. Dante cut out his jets at the apex of his leap, allowing himself to fall fast towards the monsters clambering over the wall. He selected one and corrected his drop with a microsecond jet burst. Carnifexes were the brute squads of the hive, built to take large amounts of punishment, then retaliate in kind. A power axe, such as Dante bore, would harm one, but not enough to ensure the survival of the attacker. Dante had 1,500 years' experience in warfare. There was little new he could learn of any martial artistry. He had fought hundreds of things as big as Carnifexes before, and slain dozens of Carnifexes besides. He fell like a meteor onto the creature's swollen head. With the weight of transhuman and battle armor multiplied generously by gravity, Commander Dante used the impetus of his fall to split the thing's cranium with the Arx Mortalis. Purple brain matter splattered his armor as he dropped past. Dante followed his blow, falling away over the Carnifex's shoulders and spore chimneys towards the seething tide of attack beasts hammering at the foot of the wall. He adjusted his weight a touch, somersaulting through the creature's broodmates, dodging a swiping talon, moving over whip-like tentacles that flickered out at him. The lesser creatures fired upwards, their weapons' grubs splattered upon his armor, their acidic innards steaming as they dissolved on his golden plate. Close to the packed mass, he ignited his jump-pack jets again, incinerating Hormigaunts, leaping up to spear him with their scythe-like talons, then flew back to the parapet. His honor guard thumped down around him, one after the other. The blood swords were stationed on that part of the defenses, their armor darker red than the blood angels. They fought all the harder for seeing the Lord of Baal among them. Another of the climbing carnifexes bore multiple smoking power blade wounds all over its body. Dante's guard had targeted its joints, and one claw dangled from a red skein of sinew. As Dante looked past it, he swore loudly. The carnifex he had decapitated was still climbing, coming up behind the one wounded by his guard. With the primary brainstem destroyed, its weapon symbiote took on the task of directing the creature's massive body. Puppeted by its gun, the carnifex clambered on upwards jerkily. Its ruined head pumped yellow alien blood down the wall. The tongue, still attached by the root to the shattered skull, flapped about like a wet flag. None of this discomfited it. "By the blood, it is not possible to kill these things," swore Dontoriel. "Well, you know that, brother," said Dante. Dontoriel jerked his head at his gold-clad comrades. They rose again and dived at the one-clawed carnifex. They flitted about it in whooshing jet bursts, every maneuver timed for maximum fuel efficiency and ending in a strike. Jump packs were inelegant devices not intended for true flight. Bulky, noisy, hungry, compared to the finer constructs of some races, they were clangorous toys. But in the hands of blood angels, imperial jump packs transcended their limitations. It was possible to forget what they were and see in the skill of the space marines the graceful flight of true angels. A fatal blow slashed out, cutting away the carnifex's second claw completely. For a moment it held its place, then overbalanced and fell, roaring into the milling sea of gaunts at the bottom of the wall. Dante remained where he was, eyes fixed on his own target. The headless carnifex's huge claws continued to punch holes in the rockcrete to a steady rhythm, hauling itself up another few feet with every wall-shaking impact. It crawled directly over a heavy boulder emplacement. The space between its belly and the gun lit up with 100 explosions as the bolter fired at point-blank range, but the carnifex pulled past it, leaking fluid from fresh wounds and dragging the bolter and its machine spirit free of the mounting as it climbed. Dante aimed the perdition pistol and waited for the carnifex to lift its claw again. For a moment in each second, the weapon symbiote was exposed. Bred in the shape of a long fluted cannon, the thing looked like an artifact, but it was independently alive and intelligent. Half-formed limbs curled around the base of its barrel snout. The last vestiges of an alimentary tract could be picked out towards the rear. Most tellingly of all, a large yellow eye stared out malignantly from the stock where the carnifex's lower limb melded with the gun's mechanisms, if they could be called such. Dante adjusted his aim. The claw slammed into the rockcrete again, obscuring the secondary beast. The other claw smashed into the wall, and the headless monster rose upwards 3 feet. "It is nearly at the top!" yelled a bloodsword sergeant. The claw raised, exposing the weapon for a fraction of a second again. Dante's aim was good. The air shimmered as he fired. Where the fusion beam connected with the gun's flesh, there was a terrific roar as all moisture in the sub-beast was instantly evaporated. The resulting explosion blasted it to pieces. The carnifex continued to climb for one more claw stroke before flailing limply and falling from the wall. The beast had come within feet of the edge, and two more screeching monsters were still climbing. A devastator squad, in blood drinker's livery, deployed and opened fire with their las cannons, a second devastator unit from the blood swords close behind. 4 ruby beams of light blew holes in the lead carnifex's armor, expertly targeting the beast's primary organs. Trailing fire, it fell into the horde, crushing dozens of lesser beasts. The third of the brood paused, opened its mouth wide, and started to scream, Stark white light shone in its throat.
Bioplasma!
Shouted the Bloodsword Sergeant. Dozens of bolt guns banged, smashing into the monster. They exploded harmlessly on its chitinous armor, only a few tearing chunks out of the more vulnerable intercostal spaces. Fist-sized craters appeared all over it. One eye burst. Several rounds blew down its throat, but were there consumed by the beast's gathering incandescent fire. A further las cannon volley denied the beast the chance to spit. The light died. The carnifex slumped, dead, hanging from the wall by its claws. Dante took stock. All along the wall, similar tales were being told. Carnifexes tumbled from the fortifications, riddled with smoking holes. Newly built corpse ramps burned under sustained plasma and melter fire. He called up his strategic overview. The wall remained a solid green line. Three breaches glinted red, but quick vox reports and glimpses through the eye lenses of others informed him that these were places where carnifexes had clambered over. The wall itself remained whole.
"Such a fruitless expenditure of assets," said Dante. "If they continue to pursue their objective so thoughtlessly, we will crush them."
"Aye, my lord," said Don Toriel, looking out over the surging horde. "But they have plenty to spare. The second wave approaches."
"We must make sure they do not pile the corpses up, Don Toriel. A few carnifexes in the perimeter will be simple to deal with, but if we have to engage a host of gaunts, we will lose control of the situation and be forced to fall back. I am going to send you to..."
Dante was cut short by an eerie wailing from the Arx Angelicum, an angel's cry that cut Dante's soul. There was only one location that would generate such an alarm.
Captain Raxietel's voice crackled over the vox.
"My lord, we have Xenos inside the fortress. There are gene stealers within the hall of sarcophagi."
Dante activated his widecast vox.
"Chapter Master Urkon of the Blood Swords has command of the second line until further notice."
And he activated his jets again, blasting over the ground between the second line and the Arx Angelicum. His sanguinary guard followed.
"How did they get in?" he demanded over the vox. "If there is an unguarded breach, there could be thousands of them inside."
"Unknown, my lord. I have an auger team scanning the lower levels to see if they can lock it down. We have traced the general area to Section 9 Phi. I have sent several squads and our blood thralls into the Cantabrian mesozone to head off any further attack."
Capsin Raxetiel was running fast enough to make a space marine pant. The impact of his boots boomed off stone.
"I'm heading to the Hall of Sarcophagi now, myself."
"Double the guard on the void generatorum and reactor halls," said Dante.
"Sergeant Frenze is already there. I have three more squads en route. No reports of hostiles anywhere as yet."
"Good," said Dante. "Beware, this could be a diversion. Keep me informed of everything."
"My lord."
Captain Raxietel's voice cut out. Dante swore. Ancient, powerful, secundum oaths. The breach would not be large, otherwise the Arx Angelicum would be under full-scale assault. That was the one reassuring fact of this debacle. If there were a diversion, targeting the Hall of Sarcophagi was a stroke of tactical genius. Within its blood-filled caskets, neophytes underwent the year-long ritual of the insanguination. Such a brazen assault on the chapter's future would send his men into a fury, and that would dull their thinking. He hoped the alien mind of the swarm was merely being vindictive, or was hell-bent on wiping out the chapter. But those were the low plans of animals, and Dante thought the hive mind to be of a far higher degree than that. He looked upwards as he flew. As yet, the void shield still rippled over the fortress monastery. He was thankful for Captain Raxietel's level-headedness. The black majesty of the Arx Murus towered ahead, flashing with the reports of giant weapons. He was closest to the maxillary gate, where the walls projected out over a gatehouse like a closing mouth. Alarms bleeped urgently in Dante's ears. His gaze flicked to the top corner of his faceplate display. His fuel indicator was running rapidly to zero. His suit's machine spirit informed him when his fuel reached a dangerous level, allowing him time to land safely. He ignored it, burning the last seconds of his supply to send himself forward and upward.
"Get me a transport, something fast. My jets thirst and can carry me no more."
Stuttering fire, the jets blew out. Momentum carried Dante forward 100 yards, but Baal's robust gravity caught up with him and he was dragged down on a steep curve. He hit the sand hard. He couldn't roll because of the bulk of his jump pack and came down in a staggering run that ended in a fall. His teeth jarred in his head as his foot hit the rockcrete. Internal shock absorbers took death out of the impact, but something gave in his leg, and every forward step brought a sharp pain in his knee until his armor's pharmacopeia detected the hurt and dulled it, though the bone ground as he ran. He opened the adrenal valves on his helm, elevating his heart rate to dangerous levels. There was only so much a Space Marine's enhanced physiology could take, but he could not afford to be cautious. Dante's jump pack was of ancient and powerful make. He had outpaced his bodyguard. They caught up with him as he ran, landing around him in perfect formation. "Get back up," he commanded. "Get inside. Head for the void genitorum."
"My lord!"
Dontorio led his followers off, stepping up into the air as if it were solid ground. The maxillary gate opened. 5 combat bikes sped out onto the landing fields, plumes of sand sprayed from their rear wheels. Now the work of war had begun, the clearing was neglected, and the desert was swallowing the fields again. The bikes roared up and skidded to a halt. The biker sergeant leapt off his steed and knelt at his lord's feet.
"Take my machine, my lord. Go quickly," he said.
Dante leapt onto the bike without a word, the encumbrance of the jump pack nothing to so graceful a warrior. Wheels spinning, he wrestled the heavy machine around in a circle and headed back towards the Arx Angelicum at speed. The gates were left open for him. He did not dismount, but sped on, thundering through his fortress. The labyrinthine ways and halls of the Arx Angelicum whipped by as he headed down. The bike left tire marks on pristine stairs and shattered the quiet of sacred halls with bellicose engine noise. The Hall of Sarcophagi was deep beneath the surface, far from the light. Dante slewed his borrowed combat bike around tight corners, bursting through the hall's modest gates into the long, low expanse of the chamber. Rectangular in shape, and lined down both long edges by caskets of ivory and plasteel, the Hall of Sarcophagi was a place of peace. There, within its sacred precincts, diseased, malnourished boys were remade into angels for the greater glory of the Imperium, and weary warriors might rest a while from the toil of battle. Ordinarily, the silence was interrupted only by the quiet hum of machines and the whisper of robes across the polished floor. Its peace was in ruins. Space Marines fought desperate close-quarter battles with gene-stealers. There was precious little cover in the hall for the aliens to utilize, but the gene-stealers were everywhere, and the Space Marines hesitated to use the full destructive potential of their weapons for fear of hitting the next generation of neophytes dreaming their way through apotheosis. They relied on single shots, aiming carefully so as not to kill their own kin, and that allowed the gene-stealers to use their superior speed. They scuttled at the Blood Angels, leaping at them with their claws outstretched, tearing them apart in a flurry of raking strikes. With the warriors of the 8th Company at his side, Dante roared into the hall, the bolt guns mounted on the fairing of his combat bike barking, the Arx Mortalis crackling with wrathful power. He had not ridden one of the machines for centuries, but his skill was as accomplished as when he had been a young assault marine. He jinked past a snarling, purple-faced abomination, smiting it as he sped by. The force of his charge and the energy field of his axe reduced the alien to a shower of stringy meat and broken carapace. A second reared in front of him. Dante ran it down. Its rangy body cracked loudly under the wheels. A third jumped onto the bike, grabbing at the handlebars. A fourth made a giant leap, folding its arms about Dante's jump pack from behind. The bike wobbled as he fended off their claws. He grabbed the thing on the fairing and heaved it off in front of his bike, where it was smashed to pieces by the weight of the machine. Broken alien chitin ground in the space between wheel and bodywork. The fourth's jaws snapped at the side of his mask, super-hard teeth squealing on the ceramite. The back wheel of Dante's mount slid out from under him as he wrestled with the beast. He managed to trap the claws, scraping curls of metal from his plastron eagle under one arm, and drove back with the head of the Axe Mortalis. Its disruption field snapped and crackled. The axe's edge scored a mark in his pauldron as he bludgeoned the gene-stealer's face with the axe's flat top. Atoms fizzled, broken energy bonds arcing out as stabbing lightning. The gene-stealer's head exploded, and it fell away. But too late. Dante's bike tipped over, ploughing up shards of broken stone from the floor. His armor fountained sparks as the bike slid out of control across the hall. It slammed into a wall, crushing a gene-stealer's legs and pinning it in place. and yet still it snapped and hissed at him. Dante snatched out the perdition pistol and blasted two more aliens running at him. Several of the infiltrators sensed his vulnerability and were turning from the other space marines. One of the other bikes was down, but four remained, and they passed through the crowd of gene-stealers in close formation, bolt guns blazing, buying Dante a few precious moments. Shouting wrathfully, Dante flipped the bike upright, freeing himself and crushing the trapped gene-stealer's chest. Finally it died, its last breath a hateful rattle, yellowish blood oozing between silicate teeth. Howling, Dante spun around to face the creatures moving on him. Red stained his soul and his vision. Sanguinius's curse rose in him. Dozens of the sarcophagi were ruined, the neophytes inside torn to pieces in their sleep. Dante experienced a father's insane fury at the sight. Anger threatened to overwhelm him. Be not rage, lest rage become all you are. The words of the bloody catechism rang in his mind. Let the fourth virtue guide and save you, until all is lost and restraint be abandoned. This is what they want, he told himself. This is why they are here. Snarling like a beast, he fought back the urge to slay these monsters at the cost of everything else. If he lost himself, he would lose the battle. Still, they must die. It was not a question of how they died or how he killed them, for they would die. It was a question of where his mind was when he was done. He swung his axe in crackling arcs. A gene-stealer's exoskeletal armor was tough, but no match for a powered blade. Their arms came free at the passing of the edge, their heads separated from necks deferentially, as if they inconvenienced the axe's machine spirit and would make amends. Blood and flesh sprayed in gory rain. Dante's armor was painted black and yellow by vile Xenos fluids. It was fortunate the Tyranid ichor was repellent, or he would have struggled to contain the red thirst. Space marines were falling all around the far end of the hall, their ceramite ripped open by alien claws. Dante despaired to see so many red-armored bodies lying on the ground, and still his warriors were dying. A bike roared past him, engine afire, and exploded against the far side of the chamber, smashing three sarcophagi to pieces. Dante found himself surrounded by a dozen purple and white horrors. The noise of bolter fire was giving out. His men were being slaughtered. So it comes to this, thought Dante. He set the terror-field projector built into the death mask's halo to maximum. The arcane psychic technologies whined hard, and a pressure grew in his head. He bellowed out his anger, and the projector amplified it. A human foe would have fallen helpless with fear, but Dante was screaming his defiance at a mind far greater than his, and the gene-stealers did no more than flinch. It was a slender advantage that Dante used. He threw himself forward. The mass of his armor and jump pack knocked two of the enemy flying, and he laid into the rest before they recovered. If you are to die, die well, he said to himself. More and more were coming for him. He had lost count of how many he had killed. They pressed in. He cut them down with his axe. He turned them to steam with a perdition pistol, but there were too many, and they crushed his arms against his side. My lord Dante! Boomed a powerful voice amplified to ear-splitting levels. Get down! With a last effort, Dante lunged forward, dragging gene-stealers to the floor with him. He fell into a flailing mass of arms and claws. The deafening racket of an assault cannon cleared a space above him. Monstrous aliens flew backwards, riddled with holes, or burst apart completely. Dante wrestled with a creature beneath him. He let his axe and pistol fall and choked the life from it with his golden hands. He did not let go until he felt the creature's spine give under its chitinous exoskeleton. The whining of an autocannon barrel powering down fell to sudden silence. Dante stood. The hall of sarcophagi was destroyed. Fires burned in broken machines. There were but a few sarcophagi left intact. Most had been ripped open. The rest were shattered by weapons fire. Dante felt a deep, sickening rage. Space marines lay dead all through the hall. Most were of Raxietel's reserve company. Among the dead lay Raxietel himself, his left arm and head torn from his body, the pieces of his corpse surrounded by Xenos dead. Three dreadnoughts stood in the doorway of the hall, weapons glowing with heat. Their giant shoulder plates also bore the double yellow blood drip of the sixth.
We could not come quickly enough to save our brothers, their leader said.
His machine-moderated voice was thick with emotion.
I too was late, Brother Damon, said Dante. They should have waited.
Dante counted 30 Space Marine corpses. The enemy is cunning. It wished to provoke us by attacking our youth. It has succeeded. He reactivated his helm strategic displays. For the time being, the second line was holding. Dontoriel, he boxed. Report.
The Genitorum is free of enemy. You were right, my lord. The void shield was their target. We engaged them near the first gateway. The enemy were annihilated. We are chasing down the survivors.
Relief coursed through Dante, easing the hammering of his hearts. He switched vox channels, hunting out Corbulo's private channel.
Captain Raxietel has fallen. Brother, attend to the extraction of his gene seed personally. He was a warrior of rare skill.
How many dead? Replied Corbulo.
The sound of fighting raged in the background. Corbulo's ident signum placed him on the northern curtain wall.
30 fallen. Some are wounded.
Dante attempted to move, but was halted by the drag of his injured leg. Wound signifiers screamed for attention. Furthermore, his armor's lower assembly was impaired.
I need your help. I am wounded. I require tech marines also. My armor is damaged.
I will find one and bring him with me for you, my lord,
responded Corbulo.
My thanks.
Dante cut the vox and limped towards a wounded space marine, intending to comfort him until help arrived. A muffled explosion sounded. The Arx Angelicum shook violently. The lumens went out.
Status!
Dante voxed his entire command cadre. Incariel replied, his passionless machine voice as close to panic as Dante had ever heard.
My lord, the void shield is down.
Chapter 22. The Heart Shattered. The Lictor watched the Prey's warrior strain attack its broodmates. Prey in red fired their refined mineral spines at the Trigons. They misidentified Synapse creatures and falsely assumed the death of the largest would precipitate the confusion of the gene stealers. Their tactic worked against them. The Trigons were too strong to be easily stopped by their weaponry, leaving the gene stealers crucial moments to attack. This prey was easy. Slow to understand, slow to adapt, while the hive mind evolved 1,000 times faster. The Lictor had no opinions. It made no moral judgment. It felt no emotion. The little clash it watched through its many eyes was added to the sum total of the hive mind's knowledge. Little was to be gleaned. Observation was not its task anymore. With complete disinterest, the Lictor retreated into the shadows. Many ways revealed themselves to the creature's bewildering suite of senses. Stealthy sonar pulses sounded out secret paths. Psychic resonance and scent revealed the location of prey concentrations that must be avoided. It slunk through cracks barely wider than its head, compressing its body to an astounding degree. The energy skin of the prey hive was generated by devices buried in this segment, all protected by rock and mineral adaptations. They thought it safe. They were mistaken. The Lictor crawled along dusty conduits. Whenever it sensed a maintenance drone or servitor, it froze, shrinking into the dark until the thing had passed. It pressed on, deeper into the machinery of the prey hive, following the unique vibration patterns of the shield genitorum. The tremors of the battle outside were easy to discount. It had no trouble finding its way to the target. Deep inside a conduit, it stopped. A hole a foot across, crammed with pipes, led downward into the guts of the prey's device. It crouched low, tentacled mouth feeling around the hole. Thrills of electrical energy tingled in its brain. Beneath it was the prey creature's energy nexus. This was the way. Its hands were incredibly dexterous. With them, it wrenched out the pipes and cables, cutting them where necessary with razor claws and teeth, hacking and tearing until the hole was clear. The last cable broke and slipped away down the shaft. Some half-biological thing came rushing to investigate. The Lictor slashed out with its scythe-like upper claws, before it could raise the alarm. The lictor leaned over the hole again. Probing tentacles provided a perfect measurement of the hole's size. Even now the cabling was gone, the hole was still too small to admit the lictor. Without hesitation, it tore its upper scythe limbs off. When the hive mind had reshaped its ancestors, it had left the neural architecture for pain intact, but though the lictor felt the agony, it did not trouble it. Now it would fit, its body convulsed, controlled muscle spasms, moving its exoskeletal plates and endoskeletal structure apart. Its skull flattened, the sutures between sections cracking wide. Its remaining limbs popped out of their sockets. The lictor drooped its way towards the hole and with a shivering rush slipped inside and down, lubricated by its own blood. Flesh hooks flicked out from its ribs, dragging it downwards towards the electric hum of the field generator. The lictor could feel the machine in its mind. The energy skins of the prey were but one of their technologies that utilized the energies of the immaterial universe that lay over that of matter. Crude, ineffective. Most prey species were like this one, changing the world to suit them rather than changing themselves. All had fallen to the superiority of the hive. A flickering light registered on the lictor's eyes. It was close. The light grew brighter, then became painful. The lictor cared nothing as its eyes were blinded. It pressed doggedly on. The conduit ended. Had it still been able to see, the lictor would have witnessed a crackling sphere of cold energy. But it did sense the magnetic field holding the force in place. It could smell the tang of psychically stressed iron. It slithered from the conduit towards the scent of iron, seeing its way by sonar and magnetic senses. Tapping hands found the thing it sought. To the Imperium, it was a field-generating spike. To the lictor's magnetic senses, it was a glowing pillar of cool light surrounded by radiating bands of force. The lictor embraced it like a monster sneaking into bed to devour the sleeper. This pivotal act was performed unnoticed. Not even the hive mind was truly aware of what the lictor did, for its constituent parts performed every action automatically. A man does not feel his blood cells about their work. An internal convulsion squeezed thin-walled cysts seeded throughout his body, an adaptation it had grown specifically for this mission while waiting in the desert. Cellular walls broke, mixing chemicals that were inert alone, but when catalyzed, formed a potent bioacid. The pain this caused could not be ignored. Agony racked its body. It suffered, but the instinctive responses to pain its ancestors possessed had been taken long ago. The lictor did not let go. It could not. It held on tightly to the spike as its body dissolved. Liquid seeped, then flooded all over the spike. With slow certainty, the acid ate its way through the metal. Energy shorts burst from the corroded surface. The spike collapsed into itself and fell away from the side of the reaction chamber. The cold power it held in check wobbled on its axis, then failed. The explosion that followed heralded the beginning of the end for the prey. The lictor lived until the last moment, certain vascular adaptations enabling its brain to outlive the death of its body and communicate its success. It felt no satisfaction at achieving its mission, no exhilaration, no release at its death. It felt nothing at all before it died, and nothing after, either. Dante went at a limping run up from the hall of sarcophagi. His damaged armor ground and caught, its machine spirit singing a plaintive song of alarm and dismay that begged him to stop. His knee throbbed dangerously. The three dreadnoughts of the 6th Company stumped after him, beseeching him to wait. He could not. The Arx Angelicum shook. Another explosion rocked deep at the heart of the mountain. Statuary toppled from plinths, smashing on the floor. Stone groaned and creaked. Cracks ran up walls designed to withstand major tectonic upheaval. The mountain flexed, shaking off millennia of human artifice. Dante ran for the stair of apotheosis, only to find its long steps shaken loose of their sockets and piled like broken gaming chips at the base of the shaft. "Dontoriel, report!" snapped Dante. Dust and smoke spilled downward. There was no reply.
"My lord," boxed in Kariel, "a massive reactor failure has destroyed the void shield genitorum. We will be exposed in seconds. I have major issues across all our power generation nexuses. The collapse of the shield is in danger of sparking a chain reaction right across the fortress monastery."
"Fix it before it goes critical," commanded Dante.
"My lord, it cannot be done, not without taking 60% of our power generation offline."
More explosions rocked the ancient fortress. Alarms wailed from every quarter. Dante's vox beads were a typhoon roar of shouting voices, all asking for information.
"Then shut it down," shouted Dante. "Shut the fortress down."
"My lord," said Incariel, "I
do it."
Tragedy was unfolding. The Arx Angelicum was falling. Dante hobbled on, making for the bottom of the Well of Angels. He burst into a circular shaft of galleried walkways. High above was the plaza and the nine circles of the Virtus Elysia, but he could not see that. Only a circle of pinkish-blue sky, sectioned by the triangular panes of the Dome of Angels. The watery shimmer of the void shield had gone. The fortress rumbled again. The aftershocks were decreasing. Black rubble fell past in an unseemly rush. The galleries above were falling. An uneasy quiet fell. The fortress ceased its grumbling. The sky remained free of tyrannids. Dante stared upwards. It would not last. Black curtains drew over the dome, swirling masses of flying beasts that rushed at the fort. Guns opened up all over the fortress, firing skyward, and a rain of broken bodies fell thumping onto the armor glass. There were so many of them, their corpses tumbled down like leaves into the gutters of wetter worlds. Many arrived unharmed. Living things of gargantuan size landed on skidding talons and attacked the dome directly. Vox requests beeped in his helmet, all of them marked as being of the utmost urgency. He selected Captain Borgio's vox almost at random.
"My lord, we have tyrannids all over the fortress. The aerial swarm is attacking unimpeded."
Gunfire boomed and roared all around the arcs, shaking its mighty walls. From above came a series of titanic bangs. The aerial swarms parted, making themselves into a living tornado, up whose funnel Dante looked. Through the maelstrom, thousands of heavy landing pods were falling. They could not lose the arcs. If the fortress fell, they were as good as dead. He could not fight a war on two fronts. Dante closed his eyes. With heavy hearts, he opened a battle group wide vox channel.
"All warriors, fall back to the Arx Angelicum. Abandon the second line."
Chapter 23. Blood and Flesh. Gabriel Seth was at peace. In his hands was a chain blade as tall as a full-grown mortal man that shook and snarled for blood. Over his head, guns fired unremittingly. Before him were uncountable foes. In his heart was a savage need to kill. And yet, he was at peace. He played Blood Reaver with consummate skill, sustaining its impetus so that it never stilled. A combination of weight, Seth's strength, and the blade's razored teeth had it cutting through chitin, flesh, endo and exoskeletal structures, strange alien organs and weapon symbiotes with ease. The weapon sent out fine sprays of bone meal and blood mist with every swing. Never did a tyrannid come closer than 6 feet. The length of Blood Reaver defined a hard limit around Seth that none could cross. The flesh terrors fought with savagery at last unfettered. Here was a foe whose total destruction was desired. There were no civilians to fear for on this battlefield. Freedom came in violence. It was a release. For nigh on 2 centuries, Seth had exhorted his warriors to restrain themselves, curbing their worst excesses, directing what bloodlust he could not stop to the appropriate ends. For his troubles, he had been censured, tried by his peers, betrayed by his warriors, hunted by the Inquisition. None of that mattered now, none of it at all. He slew and he slew again, and as the enemy died, and Seth roared and raged at them for having the temerity to exist, a slow, cold smile crept over his face. Not even at Cryptus had he been able to enjoy such abandon. Here was vindication at last. On Baal Primus, the flesh terrors had a battlefield where they could do no wrong. A tyrannid warrior reared up in front of Seth,
Blood Reaver was already on its way to the beast's neck as it raised its death spitter. The chain blade cut through vertebrae, sending the head, jaw still snapping, wheeling through the air. The creature remained upright, jerking spasmodically, its bladed upper limbs scything. The gills of its symbiote weapon pulsed, dribbling clear mucus. Yellow, slit-pupiled eye squinting at him. The headless warrior tottered forward.
"Stay down, Xenos!" shouted Seth.
He barged the Tyranid back with his shoulder and brought Blood Reaver around in a reverse cut that gutted the Death Spitter. Acid slopped from its riven abdomen, hissing on the floor and pitting its ceramite where it splashed him. It was dead, but there were more. There were always more. High Chaplain Astaroth himself, the Redeemer of the Lost and Arbiter of the Fate of all afflicted by the curse, had declared Seth a weapon. It was a role gladly fulfilled. He pumped Blood Reaver's activation bar, revving its compact engine. The chain track spun around, flicking out gore that might clog its workings, and he set to his appointed task again. Time passed. Seth's sense of self receded. His world became the pumping of his twin hearts, the play of his muscles, the growing ache in his flesh as he fought. Seth could see no further than 40 yards in any direction. Requests for orders from the warriors stationed in the forts went unanswered. His men were individual dervishes, their squad cohesion abandoned. A sudden lull came in the fighting. Seth was short on foes. He had slaughtered every Tyranid warrior within 100 yards. Nothing but gaunts remained nearby, scurrying around the corpses of their larger cousins. Seth strode forward down the slope towards a knot of his warriors, fighting out away from the mountain. Blood Reaver, ready to begin its rhythmic slaughter again, but the Tyranids parted like water before him. A pathetic spatter of ammunition grubs cracked on his armor. Seeing Seth unharmed and unwilling to face his rage, the horde of gaunts turned tail, eerily moving in complete synchronicity, and scuttled away. Warrior broods embedded in the Tyranid second line hissed and roared and never turned their faces from him, but they too fell back. The urge was there to throw himself into the fray, to abandon sense. The black rage pulsed hot in his breast and head, seducing him with the promise of blood and death. Seth shut his eyes and quickly whispered, "By the blood am I made, by the blood am I armored." He could not see the battle raging on, but he could hear it, the bark of weapons and roars of his brothers, and the eerie screeching cries of the Tyranids. He must hear it and master his wrath. If he shut off his displays and auditory equipment and let himself sink into silence, he knew he would lose himself as soon as he reactivated them. Calm must be regained in the face of fury, he told himself. By the blood, I will endure. He let out a long breath, feeling the touch of the blood madness retreat from his mind. Time to take stock. He had attained a position up on a ridge some way from the wall of the necklace. To his front, a sea of Tyranids seethed around knots of space marines, some in the black and maroon of his own chapter, some in the silver and red of the Knights of Blood, too many in the black of the Death Company. Behind him, the counterfeit mountains of a necklace rose skyward. He had chosen to make his stand where the metal range bowed back in a U-shape, making a formulation not unlike a corrie. His forts occupied the summits of the ridges, embracing the space now misted with blue Physaline smoke and columns of black from burning Tyranid monstrosities. A makeshift defense line stopped the mouth. A few armored fighting vehicles studied this line, filling the whole of bunkers. Their tracks were chained to prevent their belligerent machine spirits taking control and driving at the enemy. So far, the crews had resisted the temptation to free them. They were making progress. The chapter as a whole was becoming better at holding down its temper and directing its berserk fury in the right direction. Such a pity it was all going to end there.
"Furious Sentinel, report," he boxed,
signaling the first of the forts. His words were bitten off, half snarled.
"My lord, you have taken a fine toll on the foe." Captain Camion's voice was phlegmy, almost strangled.
It was hard for those warriors Seth had commanded to man the guns and watch over their brothers. He would not be able to keep asking them to do so. Defense was not his preferred form of war, but Tyranids required walls to break themselves on. To give in completely to the first would result in a single charge, glorious but short-lived. Hence this hateful skulking behind fortifications.
all his chapter thirsted for the raw, unadulterated slaughter of close-quarter fighting. A third of his remaining men, already pitifully few, had succumbed to the curse and now wore the black and red of the Death Company. Apollos led them with consummate skill, wielding them as a weapon, somehow managing to coax them back and redeploy them after each attack, conserving their numbers beyond expectation, though every evening there were fewer, slain in glory during the day. More succumbed to their own bloodlust in the nights. It was nearly over. Bolts ran out. Lives ran out. Time ran out. This battle was a charade, a grand performance to keep the Space Marines occupied while the Tyranids went about their real business. On the horizon, tentacled feet ships were nosing down from the void, held aloft by giant Venus gas bladders whose rapid inflation made a rubbery booming over the plains. Feeder tubes were already creeping upward from the ground to meet the ship's pulsing mouths, and giant chimneys as grand as any imperial industrial structure were belching out shifting clouds of spores and microorganisms to aid in the digestion. Seth spent minimal time reading tracts on the mores of an enemy. He saw no point. He was first and foremost a warrior. His requirement was to know where the enemy were and how they could be killed. But he recognized the digestion phase of a Tyranid attack. His breath rushed in his helm like the snorting of a bull. The disgusting stink of Tyranid blood polluted his air supply, despite his helm's best efforts to filter it out. The trap was obvious. The Tyranids had read him well, luring him away from his forts. If his force advanced any further, he would pass through the curtain of the artillery bombardment and be isolated and destroyed. The next words he spoke were among the hardest he had ever uttered.
All companies! Regroup! Fall back to Furious Sentinel and Wrathful Vigilance! The enemy have had enough for today.
Night fell of a double blackness as Baal Primus turned its back to the sun and to Baal. The stars were blotted out by smoke and spore clouds and the endless ships of the swarm in orbit. Light came from the ground instead of the heavens. Low fires played over the horizon, where Stardam, Baal Primus's only sizable settlement, burned. The noise of human weapons firing there had ceased earlier that evening. Unlike on Baal, the war on the first moon was diffuse. Chapters were scattered across the world's surface. Dante had deployed them that way deliberately, just enough warriors to divert the Tyranids away from Baal and the Arx Angelicum, not enough to weaken the defense of the fortress monastery, spreading them out to divide the enemy's attention. The Space Marines upon Baal Primus were a token force. Most of the population had been moved, much of the rest had died in the fighting. The dark was alive with the screeches of Tyranid beasts and the thunderclaps of Space Marine guns. The ancient metal of the fallen orbitals thrummed in sympathy, remembering ancient wars in their dreams.
"What are we waiting for, Gabriel?" snarled Apollos.
He appeared from the gloom of the makeshift rampart, his grimacing skull helm alive with the flicker of gunfire from the artillery platform below.
"Why did you order us back? This is weakness. Pathetic."
"We will die," said Seth.
His fingers curled into fists as he imagined smashing Apollos in the face. Too many times the chaplain had questioned his judgment.
"We are going to die whatever you do," said Apollos. "This is an unwinnable war. You knew that when we came here."
"You knew yourself, or you would not have followed me."
Apollos laughed harshly.
"You, who are going to save the chapter, killing us all for a blood angel's whim. The irony chokes me."
Seth rounded on Apollos.
"Do not speak to me this way, chaplain.
I perform the duties of my office. You speak from your black hearts."
Apollos stepped threateningly close.
"If you do not like what I say, then confer with High Chaplain Carnarvon instead."
Apollos jested bleakly. Carnarvon had finally succumbed to his centuries-long sorrow the day before, and the same day perished in the black of the Death Company.
"You are not an authority over me," growled Seth. "I am Chapter Master. My decision stands. We fight here. We sally out when needed. We kill at the right time. I have not returned to this chapter from the brink of destruction to throw it away."
"We will die," said Apollos.
"And for the benefit of one who would have executed you had High Chaplain Astaroth not exerted his will."
Apollos slammed his hand down hard on the rampart.
"What is this? The old Seth would never have groveled before Dante.
You put the angels of Baal before your own brothers. You left our scouts to die to help Dante at Cryptus. Dozens of us fell at that shield world so that the rest of us might die here. There are less than 200 of us left, Seth. Amit's legacy has long been guttering. You will be the one to snuff it out.
Only cowards speak so. Cowards have no right to audience, said Seth. He stepped away. Apollo's hand shot out and grabbed his arm.
I am all you have left.
Anger simmered under his words. Seth respected the strength of will the chaplain possessed to keep himself in check.
The rest of the Reclusium are dead. I am the last of the Flesh Terror's chaplains, and I speak to you rightly.
Seth's breath whistled through clenched teeth. He forced the tension from his muscles. Apollos released his arm.
We should not die like cornered vermin,
a plea fueled by anger and pride.
I am an angel of the Emperor. We should die with Sanguinius's name on our lips and our weapons in our hands, not skulking behind these walls. The paltry defenses set in place on this moon are nothing.
Apollos flung out his other hand to encompass the horizon. It shook with anger.
The other chapters are destroyed. The real battle is on Baal. Dante did you a great dishonor, and he did not ask you as an equal. He ordered you. You obeyed.
There is no dishonor in what we do, said Seth.
He wanted to agree with the chaplain. His soul ached to plunge into the fire and never emerge, but he could not. He was chapter master, guardian of Roth, and he would use it, not it him.
Dante has tasked me with safeguarding the last feather of our Primarch. There is no greater honor than that. We can go out, as you say, full of righteous fury, and slaughter the enemy until we fall. But we will fall quickly. By remaining here, we buy the Blood Angel's time. We divert the attention of the Hive Mind, and we ensure, Chaplain, that at least a portion of this bloodline you say you care so much for survives.
We will perish needlessly. The Flesh Terrors will be no more.
This is no longer about our survival or damnation. This is about the survival of the heritage of Sanguinius,
Seth shouted right into Apollos' helmeted face. The skull remained impassive. Seth turned away, teeth grinding. He pressed the heels of his palms into his eyes, letting the chill of ceramite on skin cool some of his rage. Apollos made a noise of utter contempt.
Dante has changed you for the worse, Seth. Dante sees you as a savage. He uses you as a tool, and you are. I look to Centaur Jewel and see the old Seth. He does not hold back. He will die gloriously. We will die like dogs for the benefit of Commander Dante. No one else.
Apollos stormed away, his ink-black armor swallowed up by the night. Seth spat out over the rampart and looked over the plain to where the Knights of Blood fought. Jewel had ignored Seth's wishes and established his operations close by the Flesh Terror's position. By all rights, they should have been wiped out three times over. Jewel had done exactly what Seth would not, plunging his forces directly into the heart of the enemy. Flashes of bolt-gun fire and vox-amplified howling were the sole indications they survived amid the churning mass of aliens. He respected and loathed the Knights of Blood. They fought with the strength of 10 men each and reaped a terrible toll on the enemy. They did not fear the rage and the thirst, as too many of his cousin chapters did. The Tyranid blood was not their sole tally on Baal Primus. The number of mortals had dwindled fastest near the position of the Knights of Blood. Very few of them had been killed by the enemy. Seth was glad it would all be over soon. In the Knights of Blood, he saw his chapter's future as rage-fueled animals who fought without restraint. That future had shortened considerably, but damnation still had time to claim them. While he drew breath, the Flesh Terrors would attempt to be of some service. Baal was coming up, bathing the hordes of Tyranids in the Badlands in pink planet shine. The Mother World rose quickly. Seth watched it until the equator rolled over the horizon and the Arx Angelicum became visible. He looked to the location of the Fortress Monastery through Void War discharge and swarms of Tyranid ships. Occasional flashes of light on the surface far away indicated that the Blood Angels still held out. Transfixed by the lights, Seth punched at the rampart with his left fist, landing blows in time with the guns that got heavier the more he thought. Apollos was right, but Seth knew he was also right. There must be a middle way. Alarms blared, breaking his concentration. Searchlights snapped on, bringing a wide section of the Badlands into brilliant illumination. Hundreds of massive assault beasts were moving forward. Gunfire from the two forts was immediately redirected upon them, but though the ground shook and buckled under the bombardment, the creatures' armor was thick, and precious few of them fell. Seth heard their support broods before he saw them, a chittering, churring, screeching, a darker blackness on the night, and a torrent of bodies with beating wings flashed in the searchlight beams. Seth grinned with feral glee. It appeared his choice of death was to be dictated for him. The Tyranids were making another assault. Apollos got his wish, though not for the reasons he had put forward. Seth led half of his warriors in a charge into the Tyranids in an attempt to reach Centaur Jewel, preempting the attack upon his forts. His men joyously abandoned their guns and took up chainswords and bolt pistols, rushing after their master into the fray. Darkness made no difference to Seth. He killed in the light and he killed in the dark with equal efficiency. The night was the same as the day had been, save only that now upon his back, secured in a magnetic tube locked to his armor, was the reliquary of Amit and its precious cargo. He let the red thirst slip free of all bonds, his teeth extended, digging into his lower gums. He salivated for blood, even for the vile ichors of the Tyranids. He would kill them all, and then he would sate the lesser of Sanguinius's curses. That was his pledge to himself. "By the blood am I made strong," he roared, gutting a gene-stealer. Its fellows ran at him, deadly claws extended. If a single one got within striking distance, he was as good as dead. Seth laughed. Not one of them got close. He cleaved them in two. Bolt rounds from his honor guard punched them from their feet. His warriors ran beside him in a shallow spear tip, howling and roaring as they smote the foe. The last of his death company gave out strangled cries as they bludgeoned their opponents to death. His battle brothers barely had any more restraint. Harahel, first company champion, was a snarling dervish. Belfield, the librarian, wielded his anger as a psychic bludgeon, smashing aside the enemy in wide swathes. Flesh-tearers' dreadnoughts stamped through the mass of Tyranids, waist-deep in lesser beings. Lightning claws spinning, they engaged the monstrous beasts of the enemy, coring deep, bloody holes in their chitinous armor. Stuttering light cast by the disruption fields of power weapons strobed the battlefield. Searing plasma blasts brought short noons to the dead of night. "We are wrath! We are fury!" the flesh-tearers chanted. "We are the blade of the angel. We are the death of the alien." Screaming, killing, the flesh terrors ripped through the phalanx of heavy assault creatures moving towards the forts. A few guns still fired up there. They were inconsequential. Fury carried them forward. Crack grenades jammed into bony hollows and breathing vents brought carnifexes low. Volleyed plasma pistol shots immolated trigons. To Seth's left, his men closed on a Tervagon, riddling its birthing sac with bolt shells. Termagaunts flopped out, half alive, from the ruin of the alien womb, slain before they assumed full awareness. A dozen chainswords dipped in and out of the Tervagon's exposed guts, bringing the mighty creature to death. The Tyranids had adapted themselves to the Blood Angel's propensity for violence. They had learned at an exponential rate all the weaknesses of their enemy, but their knowledge was generalized. They were not prepared for this charge. They were not prepared for the flesh terrors. The Tyranids lumbered about, becoming entangled, attempting to make space for their weaponry, but the closely packed nature of the horde prevented them. They fired anyway, sending frenzied grubs, hypertrophic seed pods and acid sprays at Seth's men, hitting their own kind instead. The organisms that made the Tyranids' munitions were programmed not to harm recognized phenotypes, but acids and pyrochemical mixtures knew nothing and burned Tyranids as easily as men. Flaring chemical fire bathed the battleground in weird colors. Bone-dry soil turned into slurry with a spilling of so much Xenos vitae. Blood pounded in Seth's skull to the rhythm of two hearts. "By his blood are we made, by his blood are we armored, by his blood shall we triumph. Forward, forward, to the knights of blood!" Another monster died, and another. The noise of bolt guns and more chanting came from a shock ridge ahead. "Centaur Jewel!" roared Seth. "Centaur Jewel, I have come for you!" With a surge of near ecstatic exhilaration, Seth ran at a massive carnifex, lopping off the snout barrel of its bonded cannon.
The thing was powerful but slow, almost pecking at Seth with its crustacean's claws. Seth was too fast. Two well-placed blows with his sword blinded the monster, and he ran up its shoulder, rode its frenzied bucking until he stood athwart its spine. Reversing Blood Reaver, he rammed it downward, struggling as the weapon skidded on the beast's living shell. He fought with the eviscerator until it snagged on an edge of chitin and pulled forward, burrowing itself into the beast's back. The carnifex crashed forward, dead, and Seth leapt free. Figures in silver and red appeared, intermingled with the aliens. Some moved to attack him. He parried the blows of one, shoving him back so that he disappeared into the press of the melee. He was forced to kill another. On he went, slaughtering everything in his path, until a ragged banner came into view, and a giant figure stood upon the ridge's edge.
"Centaur Jewel!" Seth called.
He barged past a knight of blood, knocking the weapon from another's hand. Jewel roared and jumped down the slope, feet slamming into the ground before Seth. He swung his chainsword. Seth caught its edge upon Blood Reaver. The motors of their weapons whined as teeth tracks jammed against one another.
"Centaur Jewel," said Seth.
He threw back the other chapter master.
"Dampen your fury."
The knight of blood recovered and raised his weapon to strike again. Seth shouted back. Jewel halted and lowered his sword. From head to foot he dripped with alien fluids. Rents in his armor fizzed with sealant foams. A sundered power cable sparked.
"You deign to share the field with us after all," said Jewel,
his voice strained with the effort of not leaping forward to attack Seth. The fighting was abating around them. Knights of blood formed a circle around the two chapter masters. Flesh terrors matched their counterparts, all of them constantly in motion. Seth reached up and tore his helm free. He had not realized in his fury that it was raining a salty, acidic drizzle. He blinked the stinging liquid away from his eyes.
"The Tyranids are feasting. This world is lost," said Gabriel Seth.
He too felt the urge to fight, to attack and kill the Knight of Blood, to cast aside all reason and end his life with one final heroic duel. He kept his passions in check. He had something else in mind.
"You can fight me, or we can fight them together."
Jewel growled.
"I should kill you."
He took a step forward.
"The time for alliance is done. There is only blood."
Jewel's men formed up around him. Seth's flesh terrors responded in kind. Bolt guns raised. The rage rose in them all. Fratricide was a heartbeat away. Seth gunned Bloodreaver's engine and held it ready for violence.
"I was correct," said Jewel thickly. "You and I are just the same. Such glorious slaughter we could have made, if only you had listened. Now it is too late."
"It is not," Seth roared.
With a great effort of will, he threw down Blood Reaver and tugged the tube from his back, knocking the top off and allowing Amit's reliquary to slide out into his hands.
"I will not let the rage take me here," said Seth, holding out the reliquary. "I will not pointlessly die as a beast."
At the sight of the reliquary, the anger of the others faltered.
"I will not fight at the rage's behest. I fight for Sanguinius. My death will count for something."
Jewel stared at the reliquary, his head bowed, his weapon wavered and lowered.
"For the great angel," he said, his voice quiet. "We fight for the Imperium." "Not for fury's sake," said Seth.
He held the reliquary high. As he did so, a clear light shone from within through the fretwork of the metal. At its touch, their anger bled away, and flesh tears and knights of blood fell to their knees in wonder, leaving Jewel and Seth standing alone.
"I made a promise to the Master of the Blood Angels to safeguard this artifact. I intend to keep it," said Seth. "What do you suggest?" said Jewel. "Baal Primus is finished. I have called in my fleet to evacuate us. I will return this relic to its home in the Basilica Sanguinarum. I will allow you to join us as you requested. Set aside your ban on fighting alongside others. Return with us to Baal, where we will die with purpose."
Chapter 24. Paradise Lost. Piles of broken wings were heaped high like bizarre leaves from stone trees. The Walk of Angels had become a walk of death, and all its lofty heroes cast down from their plinths. Gunfire riddled the podiums of the fallen statues, blasting apart stone brought from faraway worlds to grace the Arx Angelicum. Beauty had made her home there since the dawn of the Imperium, but she was driven out. The Arx Angelicum burned. On every level of the towering fortress, war raged. The Tyranid aerial swarm, free to act once the void shield was down, beat back the defenders from the stepped outer galleries of the Arx Murus. Section by section, guns fell silent, and Tyranid ground organisms were brought to bear. Carnifexes battered at the fortress's gates. Lithe-limbed gene-stealers climbed mirror-sheened walls. Harrispexes vomited cargoes of smaller beasts onto parapets manned only by corpses in power armor. Shortly after the void shield fell, the Dome of Angels shattered. Weakened by acidic drool and weapons effusions, the transparisteel gave out under a bombardment spat out by convulsing weapons tracts of the ships in orbit. There were too few Space Marines vessels left to prevent this. The war in space mirrored that upon the ground. The united front of the Sons of Sanguinius was broken into myriad small actions. Seeing the weakness in cohesion between the chapters, the hive mind had driven them apart and was eliminating them one by one. What reports made it to the Strategium through the Tyranid denial broadcasts spoke of chapters shattered and battle barges destroyed. The Invictrix, flagship of the Charnel Guard, was downed over Baal Secundus. The scattered remains of its hull burned in the great salt wastes of Dante's birth. The flesh-tearer's Victus had broken flight and had not emerged from the far side of Baal Primus. All told, a dozen battle barges were verified destroyed. 10 more were missing, presumed lost. Hundreds of other craft were gone. The entirety of the Golden Sun's war fleet, whose auric vessels had patrolled the northern reaches of the galaxy since the 38th millennium, were shattered into gold-rich fragments orbiting Baal's outer worlds. Their fabled Librarius was lost to the void. Their serfs were consumed by the hive mind, their battle brothers reduced to a handful of scattered survivors. The Angel's Excelsis had died in flames. The Scions of Sanguinius were down to a sole battle cruiser limping away from the conflict. So it went on. Mortis mark after mortis mark came in. Not the single runes that denoted the loss of a battle brother, but rare and terrible symbols that spoke of the deaths of companies and of chapters. The Angels Glorious, the Burning Blood, the Brothers of Jarad, wiped out without a sole survivor. The situation on Baal was little better. And as Dante's soul shook with each instance of dreadful news, so the Arx Angelicum rocked to the pounding of bio-artillery and ram-beasts hurled to their deaths from high orbit. The time for tight cooperation between the chapters was over, ended far more quickly than Dante had feared possible. The dwindling warriors defending the Arx against the swarms fell back on what they knew, fighting by chapter, company, and squad, until massive casualties rendered even these modest groupings irrelevant, and too often warriors found themselves alone to face the foe and the thirst before the end. Like hive-world gangs, bands of survivors carved out territories to defend within the fortress monastery. In the Heavenward Redoubt, a semblance of order remained, but outside the Keep of the Arx, the Sons of the Great Angel were forced back corridor by corridor. No matter how many of the enemy they slew, there were always more, and so they were worn down, isolated, and ultimately destroyed. Although he was among the greatest military minds of his age, Dante could formulate no strategy against such attritional murder. Had the void shield not fallen, the chapters of the blood might have persisted and eventually triumphed. It had been done before, on Macrag, but the behemoth had been a modest shoaling compared to the Leviathan, and the void shield was gone. Dante fought where he could not command. He vented his frustration personally, axe to flesh, against the beasts that would shatter his legacy. Hubris had damned him. He had fallen for the lies of his own legend. Behemoth had been driven back. Surely he, Dante, could do the same with Leviathan. The Tyranids were closing on the redoubt's gates. If the keep were to fall, the fight would be over. Strike teams fought on multiple levels, attempting to seal the ways up to the nerve center of the Arx. He had awarded himself the most onerous sector, as penance. The Walk of Angels was the broadest, least defensible of the approaches to the redoubt's middle section. The far end was accessed from the plaza via the impressive Tribunalis Victorum, an architectural wonder become tactical liability. The left of the walk's curving length was open to the Well of Angels. Stained armor glass that had filled elegant traceries skidded treacherously underfoot. Flying Tyranid beasts flew repeatedly at the gaps in the ruined windows. Most were shot down before they could fly through by heavy bolter turrets set into the buttresses outside. They faithfully chugged away, their ammunition feeds protected by feet of rockcrete and plastile. Even so, several were gone, the turrets ripped free by suicidal attacks. The rest fired on, never tiring, their indefatigable machine spirits smashing monsters from the air. The few flying creatures that crashed into the Walk of Angels alive were injured and easy prey for the defenders. The Axe Mortalis buzzed, motes of dust bursting into nothing as Dante swept it through debris-choked air. A gargoyle, pathetic on the ground, died with a shriek and a burst of shattered atoms. He ran on, killing more maimed, winged Tyranids as he pounded towards the Arcus Elim. A tall, beautiful arch, fashioned in the early days of the chapter, it had admitted processions of the Blood Angels from the Tribunalis after every victory for 8 millennia. Dante glanced out into the Well of Angels. Teeth of glass rimmed the caldera where the remains of the Dome of Angels clung to the rock. The serene heart of the monastery was awhirl with flapping, screeching attack organisms. Weapons ensconced all around the volcano's throat fired endlessly into the swarm. The plaza was yards thick with Tyranid dead, but there were not enough guns or enough bullets to kill the numberless millions of Xenos still raining down on Baal. A mixed group of Blood Angels, Angels Numinous, and Blood Drinkers ran with Dante. Drafted mortals and warrior blood thralls provided covering fire, their lasbeams cracking down the way, felling gargoyles as they burst through into the walk. Another gargoyle skidded across the floor before Dante, its wing burned off. It screamed at him defiantly. He stamped its head flat as he ran. Dante threw himself into the cover of the Arcus Elim's massive triple-lobed pillars. Angels bearing victory wreaths of green stone looked down with blank eyes, hands held out in blessing, towards the long sweep of the Tribunalis Victorum. 100 yards down the stairs, warriors and 4 dreadnoughts of the Red Wings held a barricade of smashed stonework against a seething mass of Tyranids. No bolt missed a mark. Creatures were blown apart by the score, whole ranks of them blasted into gobbets of flesh and shards of bio-armor. Still, they came on. So it had gone on for 3 days, since the Tyranids had broken their way onto the landing below. The stairs were fully enclosed, the Red Wings were free from aerial attack. It was an excellent choke point under any other circumstances, but they could not hold the line forever. They simply could not kill all the beasts sent against them. A chime pinged in Dante's ear as another heavy bolter turret on the exterior of the walk fell silent. The walk would not stay defensible for long. The Tyranids would break through, and the Red Wings would be cut off. "Captain Dentinus, prepare to fall back," boxed Dante. The Red Wings sang as they fired. Their guns steamed from constant discharge. Dante could feel their rage, their desire to spring from cover and attack with axe and blade. The Scions of Sanguinius were not made for this kind of war. Frustration worsened their rage.
"We are holding them in place, my lord," insisted Dentinus. "We can keep the stair free."
"You will fall back to the Portus Castellum," said Dante. "The walk is compromised. Its guns die. It must be sealed at this end and the perimeter re-established at the entry to the redoubt. Prepare to fall back on my order."
"As you command, my lord," said Dentinus reluctantly.
A blood drinker's tech marine worked quickly at the far support of the arch. He and his servitors had already prepared the column for demolition. A ring of melter flasks adhered to the stone with explosive putty, wires sprouting from their opened cases. It was an ugly executioner for such a work of beauty. Dante moved aside to allow another tech marine to get at the second pillar. He could not tell which chapter he was from. His armor was covered in dust stuck to oil, his badge obscured. He could have been one of Dante's own. The rest of the warriors with Dante arrayed themselves in a firing line at the top of the Tribunalis.
Demolition is prepared, my lord, boxed the tech marine. Dante walked to the center of the line. Company, stand ready to give fire. Dentinus, fall back. Now. The Red Wings loosed a few more shots, some tarrying at their stations, loath to leave the enemy alive. Those with presence of mind locked their bolters to their armor and hauled ammunition crates from dead resupply servitors and retreated under the cover of their fellows. The four dreadnoughts were the last to leave, walking backwards up the stairs, their guns sweeping back and forth as they retreated. "Open fire!" ordered Dante. His mixed group shot over the heads of the Red Wings, holding the Tyranids back with a storm of fire. The Space Marines were able to keep up a constant fusillade until the Red Wings were close. They ceased for a moment as the 70 or so warriors ran between them, then opened up again. "Dentinus, fall back to the Portus Castellum. Gather up the mortals from along the way. You may begin preparations at the Portus Castellum immediately. You will hold the line there." "My lord!" The Red Wings streamed back towards the citadel, letting off opportunistic shots into the aerial swarm in the Well of Angels as they ran. Only when they'd crossed the last step did the dreadnoughts swivel their legs around, their torsos following, then break into a stone-shaking run. "Company," said Dante, "fall back on my command, group by group, covering fire protocol." The Tyranids surged up the stairs. Hundreds died, but free of the punishing heavy weapons fire of the Red Wings' dreadnoughts, they were able to draw closer to their enemy. "Group one, fall back," shouted Dante. Half the Space Marines turned and ran after the Red Wings. With the volume of fire halved again, the Tyranids came closer. Their breath steamed in the air. Their shrieks were deafening. The first group of Space Marines reformed 100 yards up the walk, ready to cover the others. "Group two, fall back," shouted Dante. The remainder left. All gunfire in the walk ceased. The Tyranids roared and poured up the stairs. The second group continued running through the first, towards where the Red Wings were establishing a fresh barricade in front of the huge black metal gates of the Heavenward Redoubt. Weapons turrets over the gates came online, ready for the foe. Hissing cries echoed up the Tribunalis. The first Tyranids ran through the arch into the guns of the waiting Space Marines. "My lord!" said a tech marine. He held up a detonator. For 8,000 years, the Arcus Elim had stood witness to the victories of the Blood Angels. How painfully fitting the last thing it should see was defeat. "Bring it down," said Dante. The tech marine's thumb depressed the button. The charges blew in horizontal columns of rock power so symmetrical they could have been painted. The arch cracked, slumping towards its middle. Huge chunks of masonry jammed against each other, preventing its total collapse. The first Tyranids galloped under the arch, sharp hooves slipping on the polished floor beneath its cloak of debris. "Keep firing!" someone shouted. "Heavy weapons, target the arch apex!" ordered Dante. Las cannons and missile launchers finished the demolition as the horde poured through. With a wrenching creak, stone ground on stone, and the Arcus Elim cracked down and apart. Chunks of masonry smashed into the Tyranids, their carvings shattering on the gallery floor. A rush of tumbling rock debris pounded down from above and sealed the way to the Tribunalis. The few Tyranids who made it through were gunned down. The company let out a ragged cheer. The way to the redoubt was blocked. Dante remained silent. He stared at the billowing dust. There was no victory in that moment. It was Arnupul, Holonan, Roget's Gift, and Cryptus all over again. A pathetic gesture. A pebble placed in the path of the flood, and worse for being lesser than all those that had gone before. Dante let his men cheer, but they might as well save their breath and cheer at the last Tyranid they downed before their heads were torn free of their necks. It would mean as much. Silently, the chapter master turned on his heel and strode back to the Portus Castellum. Dante waited impatiently while forge thralls worked on his armor. Blue sparks fizzed from arc welders. Plasma torches warmed the ceramite to temperatures deadly to mortals. The pristine gold was dented and covered in lubricant, sealant foam, sacred healing oils, alien blood,
and rock dust. These running repairs were all that kept it going. Captain Adonisio addressed a gathering of battle-worn captains from numerous chapters. The strategium shook. Dust sifted from the ceiling, interfering with a tactical hololith. The Arx Angelicum took center stage in the light map, its black rock described in blue angular lines. A wash of red lapped around its feet. More red dotted its ramparts and its galleries. It was a giant corpse infested by maggots. Every blob represented a brood of tyrannids. Each brood could be dozens strong. The blobs ran into each other, a blanket smothering the life out of the fortress monastery. Individual components in the red were indistinct unless zoomed in on to the finest level.
"Then I should go out into the thick of them, bolt gun in hand, and count them myself," thought Dante furiously. "The lower halls are still contested," Adonisio was saying. "The angels numinous hold the gallery of arts, but they are losing numbers all the while. We have major problems here in the Well of Angels. The Virtus Elysia is overrun on all but the ninth circle. We retake the plaza only to lose it to the enemy daily. I suggest we abandon it. Until now, all enemy reinforcements have been coming down the Well of Angels where our guns might take a toll on them, and via the Portus Gehenna. The enemy are making more inroads. 3 hours ago, tyrannid burrowing organisms penetrated the Arx Murus here and here.
Bright white tunnels pushed their way through the thickness of the volcano's walls.
They outflanked us at the Elohim Gate and Gates of Dondris. Soon they will have them open.
How did this happen? Said Dante angrily.
Where is Zargo? Where are the angels in Carmine? They were tasked with holding the fourth sector.
And Anicio glanced at Captain Sendroth of the Blood Angels Ninth.
Answer me, said Dante angrily.
Zargo died an hour ago, my lord, along with 2/3 of his chapter, said Sendroth. The angels in Carmine are devastated. Half of them could not restrain themselves at the loss and let the thirst take them. They killed many before they fell. There are barely a company's worth of them left.
Were you not informed, my lord? Said Adonisio. I sent out runners.
Dante shook his head.
They never reached me.
Without a wider box network, we're doomed, said
Captain Ilias of the Sanguine Host.
We are attempting to boost our vox gain to break through the Tyranid jamming field, but their methods have become more sophisticated since we last fought them, said Incariel. They seem to know which frequencies to shut down as soon as we open them up. Only brute force will overcome it. But when we push, they push back harder. Our capacity to overcome their denial broadcast is lessening. They make a priority of our vox and augur arrays.
Our hard lines are being targeted along with our energy network. We have power outages in every area except the upper levels of the redoubt and the Librarius, said Quaiston, forge master of the Blood Drinkers. They are deliberately crippling our communications.
So soon, we shall be deaf and blind, said Dante angrily.
The representation of the Arx glowed solidly, challenging Dante to find a solution. He could see none. All but the upper levels of the Arx Murus and the redoubt itself was contested or overrun. The galleries on the mountainside were lost. A handful of bastions held out. They were isolated islands in an ocean of xenoforms, though their guns kept firing for now. Dante had not looked outside the fortress monastery to see what awaited them in the desert.
The redoubt is our last refuge, said Dante.
At his words, Adonisio highlighted the heavenward redoubt. The castle keep of the Arx was a tall drum built into the murus, topped by the citadel reclusium.
There have been no incursions within the walls here, unless there are more bad tidings I'm unaware of. The redoubt remains inviolate, said Adonisio, for now.
Then we must withdraw again, said Sendroth. Bring all our warriors into the keep. Our forces are being isolated and cut off. We will be shattered and eliminated piecemeal. Concentrated within the citadel, we may hold out for months, if need be. Until help arrives, said Sendroth.
If help arrives, said Captain Borgio, leadenly. The master of recruits had seen most of the Blood Angel scouts die over the last week.
What is the situation beyond the walls? Asked Dante. Skyfall has been lost, said Adonisio.
Captain Zedranail is dead, of that we are certain. We have lost contact completely with Baal Primus. Intermittent contact from Baal Secundus suggests Angel's Fall still stands, as does the astropathic relay under the Carmine Blades. Elements of the fleet continue to harry the swarm in the void, but their combat effectiveness has now hit the steeper slope of decline, and will soon dwindle to nothing. Mephistron has not been heard from. We fear he is also dead.
All is not lost. With the relay intact, we can yet summon help, said Malthus.
The chapter master of the exsanguinators was barely holding the first in check. The whites of his eyes were as red as his armor.
If there is any help to come, said Captain Essus of the Bloodswords.
We cannot rely on help. We must look to our own, said Dante. There is precious little on our worlds for the Tyranids to harvest. They will run out of monsters to throw at us eventually. All we must do is persist. We have the Citadel. There remain several thousand of us. We have already slaughtered millions of them. By the blood, we shall endure.
By the blood, we shall endure, repeated the others.
Give the order to fall back to the Citadel now, Dante commanded. All warriors are to salvage whatever they can and bring it back with them. We have lost too many of our supplies already. Whatever occurs, this will be a long siege.
The servitors and thralls finished with Dante's armor and withdrew.
Now, Adonisio, today's casualties.
Adonisio began the solemn listing of the dead, as he had every day since the invasion began. As he spoke, Ordemail and his chaplain brethren chanted prayers for the souls of the lost. The list was lengthy. Dante struggled to listen. Lightheadedness robbed him of concentration. He swayed on his feet. Adonisio's voice faltered and stopped. Pressure built behind Dante's eyes. An unnatural silence fell on the strategium. He felt as if he could not breathe, that the weight in his head was sinking into his throat and compressing his lungs. For a moment he thought he alone was afflicted, but it was not so.
What new evil of the Tyranids is this?
Gasped Malthus.
This is not the Tyranids, said Essus.
All at once, the strategium servitors began to moan and jabber in myriad tongues. Something evil swept through the gathering, causing men to fall into convulsions and space marines to drop to their knees with grunts of unaccustomed pain. The few psychers present in the strategium, mortal and Adeptus Astartes alike, screamed in agony. Thunderclaps sounded outside the monastery, and the arcs shook. Sparks fell from the ceiling. Machines gave out with bursts of fire. The world vibrated. A dreadful shriek penetrated from outside, going on and on. Dante staggered across a heaving floor, though if it moved or if it were a product of his mind, he could not say.
Open the shutters,
he commanded. He grabbed at chairs, statues, railings, anything to keep himself upright as the world convulsed under him. He staggered through the wide strategium to the far wall, where, in more peaceful times, huge windows looked out over the dunes of Baal.
My lord, the Tyranids,
began Adonisio. Dante rounded on him, his fury potent enough to match the outrage depicted on Sanguinius's golden face.
Do it! Now!
The ark swayed impossibly. Nothing short of exterminatus by cyclonic torpedo had the force to rock a mountain like that, and yet they were still alive. This was not a physical phenomenon. The jabbering of the servitors grew louder. The awful shriek competed with it in volume. Adonisio pulled away cowering serfs from the desk that operated the shutters and overrode the servitors responsible for their operation. A bass rumbling cut into the infernal howling. Massive slabs of rock, 50 yards thick, slipped away from the windows, allowing daylight into the strategium. Dante wove unsteadily to the glass. For the first time in centuries, he felt nauseous, sickened to the depths of his soul by whatever was unfolding outside. He slammed into the armor glass, armored fingers scraping on it as he struggled to remain upright. The rock shutters withdrew, leaving Dante staring out of a deep slot onto the outside world. The sky was on fire. Lightning stabbed down in a frenzy from churning clouds. Tyranid feeding tubes broke and fell. A violent wind swept across the land. Unclean energies spread through the sky, engulfing ships in writhing wreaths of hellish light. They burst and fell, burning with green flame. Reality quivered like a struck gong. All across the deserts of Baal, the Tyranids stopped and turned as one to face the heavens, their mouths open as wide as they would go. The awful shriek came from a billion alien throats. The hive mind was screaming. Baal endured a cataclysm unfolding across the entire galaxy. Darkness came to Baal as a shock of purple fire. The three worlds were engulfed in a haze of boiling energy that first swallowed the stars, then obscured each of the trio from the other. On Baal Secundus, the astropaths of the Blood Angels, sheltered behind the ceramite wall of the Carmine Blades, cried out and perished, leaving only a handful alive to experience the full horror of the warp unleashed. Deep in the Ruberica, Mephiston's coven of psychers reeled. Navigators aboard the embattled ships were blinded by soulfire. Librarians fighting in the arcs dropped convulsing to the ground, their teeth shattering under the force of their spasms. Every mind felt the touch of the warp, whether great or small. Being blessed with a portion of their father's psychic might, the scions of Sanguinius were all troubled. Guns dropped from numb hands as visions of wars lost long ago filled their minds, and the rage stirred in the breasts of everyone. The Tower of Amareo resounded to frenzied calls for blood and flesh. But the sons of the great angel were less afflicted than their foe. Screaming warp fire crashed against the gestalt soul of the Pyramids, catching it unawares. The delicate synaptic web that bound its numberless minds into one being shriveled like thread in a fire. Never before had the hive mind been so grievously wounded. Its control over its trillions of bodies was violently disrupted. High fleet was cleaved from high fleet, brood from brood, so catastrophically that for a moment the hive mind ceased to be. It recovered, quickly, diminished but alive, but that moment seemed to the hive mind an eternity of darkness. Trillions of its creatures permanently lost touch with the hive mind and were reduced to unthinking animals. For the first time in its existence, the hive mind tasted death. In the Baal system, hundreds of thousands of Tyranids died, their brain stems reduced to smoking mulch by psychic feedback. Aggressive void predators became drifting hulks in the space of an instant. In the Strategium, Dante collapsed, unconscious. Thousands of space marines of the blood followed him. Many awoke with no memory of who they were, their scarred minds full of visions of Sanguinius's death. The end of their own lives in madness and blood beckoned. The Cicatrix Maledictum had opened. Chapter 25. A Message. Master Geron Leiter glanced behind him before placing his hand upon the activation pad for the Astropathicum portal. He feared the sight of his protectors, not for their savagery, but because they would try to stop him.
"I have been down here plenty of times since the rift," he said nervously to himself. "I have every right to be here. The Carmine Blades will not remark on me going to my station."
The door opened silently. Chilled air blew outward. On the other side of the threshold was a deep quiet. Astropaths worked better without distraction. Geron Leiter glanced around a room he had shared with his fellows for a century, but which they had never seen. The numbers of astropaths who retained the faculty of vision were so microscopically small nobody bothered to record it, so far as he knew. He regarded it as a gift from the Emperor. Being able to see did not seem like much of a blessing right then. His colleagues remained in the sending cradles where they had died. The Carmine Blades were good protectors, but unsentimental. It was debatable which was worst, the smell of refrigerated meat going bad in the frigid room, or the twisted looks of horror on their sunken faces. Astropath Minoris Danil in particular looked horrifying. He had screamed so loud, his jaw had dislocated. Leiter felt guilty. It was he that had insisted that the astropaths be on duty permanently, despite the pain inflicted on them by the Tyranids' presence, in case a message got through. He had hooked them up to stim-laced nutrient feeds so they could work without rest to pierce the shadow in the warp. For this task, they had worked in unity, minds blended. Leiter's little choir was therefore as vulnerable as it could possibly be when the rift opened and reality screamed. He had been with them. He had felt their souls ripped from their bodies. He had sensed their total extinction. Guilt was a weakness, at least so the priests said. They would say that the astropaths died doing their duty as was expected. It felt like his crime, anyway. No matter how he turned the problem about in his head, he could see no way to prevent what had happened. It didn't help. He moved carefully, so as not to disturb Horden Genot, the only other living soul in the Astropathicum. It was impossible, of course. Genot's ears were as sharp as a blood eagle's, but he had to try.
Master,
Genot spoke in a whisper. Of the 7 astropaths in the relay, Leta, Genot, and Anamar Tuk had survived the opening of the Great Rift. Anamar Tuk was driven insane, and Leta had strangled her 3 days after the skies began to bleed, fearful that her untethered mind might pave the way for demonic intrusion. Genot had fared better. He at least lived and was sane, though the shock of the warp storm had wounded some fundamental part of his body, and he was too weak to be removed from his cradle. Leta alone had come through, unscathed, relatively. His mind's eye harbored painful after-images that nibbled at his sanity. Bits of his soul were sore, others were fragile. Some felt like they were no longer his, but had come from somewhere else. If he were truthful, he did not think he could trust himself completely anymore. He ignored Genot, going to his sending cradle to prepare it for his work. He set up sensor pads he would press against his shaven head. He cleaned the neural shunts and feeding tubes that plugged into the sockets in his arms.
Master, what are you doing?
Said Genot.
I have come to tidy a little, Leta lied. My strength has returned. My cradle is a mess, and it is time to remove these bodies. I thought this small work was a good place to start. It will calm my spirit.
Genot cocked his head. The spare light of the Astropathicum caught on the metal orbs filling his eye sockets, richly worked gifts of gold from the Blood Angels.
Then why are you alone? Where are your attendants?
Leta continued working.
Sleeping,
he lied.
Your tone betrays you, Astropath Prime, said Genot.
His injuries made him bold. Before the rift he would never have spoken to Leta that way. Leta supposed he had nothing to lose now.
You are going to attempt to penetrate the veil.
Leta sucked air through his teeth. He paused in his preparations. As soon as he flicked the toggles to bring the psi amplifiers online, the game would be up. He realized then he was lying for his own benefit, putting off the truth of what he was to attempt, not to spare Genot, but because he was terrified.
You are as perceptive as ever, he said, bowing his head. I am going to. I have to try. Can you feel it? The shadow in the warp has lifted for a while. This is our chance to call for help. I heard the enemy scream, said Genot with a shudder. I never want to hear anything like that again.
Well, said Leta. He sighed and was aghast at the tremble of fear that shook him.
The hive mind is wounded, but I feel it coalescing in the immaterium. If we are going to call for aid, it must be done now.
The risks of sending during a warp storm are astronomical, said Genot wearily. There has not been a storm of this magnitude ever, as far as I know. You will die. You may kill us all in the process.
I am aware of the risks, Leta laughed a little hysterically. What was merely impossible before has become incredibly dangerous instead.
He punched up the psi amplifiers. The dull voice of the machine spirit reported its readiness. The whine of machines built, passing beyond hearing into a realm only psychers like Leta and Genot could sense. Servants usually did all this. His fellow astropaths would find it impossible. Being able to observe their servants at work gave Leta a much broader understanding of how the Astropathicum functioned than most astropaths possessed. He checked over the machinery. It was working at optimal capacity. Thank the Emperor the relay's geothermal plant was still online. Before he climbed into his own couch, he activated the psi dampers on Genot's station. There was no need to subject Genot to what Leta would experience.
Master Leta, don't do that! I should help you!
Genot managed to struggle up onto his elbow.
You are improving, said Leta.
He plugged the various shunts and spikes into his interface ports with unhurried efficiency.
I am glad.
His limbs tingled with the urge to rush, to get it over and done with. He made himself take his time.
But you are still weak.
I can help. Deactivate the damper. Let me boost your sending.
No, said Leta.
He pushed the last spike home into the socket at the base of his skull. All this extra machinery was necessary to overcome the baleful influence of the red scar. It had always been onerous to use. Now he hoped the relay's booster array would increase his chances of getting a message out. To get a message out, not to survive. He did not expect to live through the next 10 minutes.
"The Blood Angels will need at least one living astropath," he said as calmly as he could. "Goodbye, Genot."
He flicked on the null sound field, shutting out Genot's voice, and eased himself into the sending trance. Leto was skilled, and reality opened gladly to him. Hell awaited him. The warp had gone from a natural calm under the influence of the shadow to a raging tempest. The hive mind skulked, wounded at the edge of his perception, the shadow it cast in the warp blasted into raggedness by a boiling seethe of soul-killing energy. Whirling eddies dragged at his soul. Things prodded at the skin of purity the Emperor's protection afforded him. It was rare to see the truth of the warp so clearly, the things that lived in it, the horror it held, so rare most astropaths below Leta's grade could safely be kept in ignorance of the warp's true nature. But he knew. Looking at the state of the immaterium, he doubted that the nature of the warp would remain secret for long. It would be impossible to conceal any longer. It hurt to be in there. Agony that he could not describe in human terms pulled at him, teasing apart the fibers of his being. A roaring red pillar of rage battered at him, spatially close, he thought, though the geography of the immaterium made location and distance in the material realm impossible to judge accurately. There was no coherency to anything. All was in flux, and, most troubling of all, the brilliant soul-searing light of the Astronomicon was nowhere to be seen. Has terror fallen, he wondered, his fear growing? Is the Emperor dead? The message he had carefully formulated would not take shape in his mind. He could not send it forth. Every attempt to make solid the metaphors he held in his imagination failed. His visualizations melted before they were born, or went bad, becoming abominations that mocked him before dissolving into the sea of souls. If he could not send, then he must receive. His heart sank. This was it. Exposing his mind to receive messages would kill him. Master Leta had never neglected his duty. With a brief prayer to the Emperor, Geron Leta opened his mind to the immaterium. He only hoped there was something to hear. Evil voices screamed out their hunger for human souls. Death screams of worlds rippled the fabric of reality. The cries of the damned, haunted, breathless winds, things caught sight.